So, always important. Our next presentation, keynote, or our presenter, is a professor of symmetric cryptography at Radboud University. I hope I pronounced that properly. Yeah, close enough. In Nijmegen, I think I got that right, in the Netherlands. He's also the security architect and principal cryptographer at ST Microelectronics. He's best known for the design of the Rheindahl algorithm, together with Vincent Riemann, which we all know of today as the Advanced Encryption Standard, or AES. He also worked on the concept of sponge functions, and the Ketchik sponge function family in particular, together with Guido Bertoni, Gilles Van Asch, and Michael Peters, which is now known as SHA-3. His current research interests include permutation-based symmetric cryptography, secure implementations, and correlation matrices. He'll be speaking to us today on the topic of deficient standards and complex certifications and whether we can escape their vicious circle. Please join me in welcoming Jan Damen.
Is it in the directory?
Yeah, it's in the directory. Right, should be. So that's okay. Where I put it. How much time do I have? Oh, yeah,
30.
30.
Okay. So, Dave, there we go.
Yeah. That's it.
All right. And it's a PowerPoint.
Full screen.
Full screen.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you very much for the introduction, and thanks for having me as a speaker here. So I'm happy that my predecessors had such nice slides, because I only have slides with bullets. Huh? So I'm afraid I was too late in starting with my preparing my slides. So also, I don't have a very catchy message, but I hope you follow me, and maybe there are some things that you can remind you. I think it's also most of the stuff you already know, but I think it's good to be reminded of a lot of these things. So let's start with a word on ST Microelectronics, because that's where I work and that's where I come from, and that's important background to know, to understand what I'm trying to say here. So it's basically it's a semiconductor company. Big company listed on the stock exchange, and we make chips for about anything. And one of these types of chips are secure, what we call secure microcontrollers, or used to be called smart cards, but now it's used in many places. And I work, in fact, in this division that's called the Secure Microcontroller Division. It's spread over different sites, but our site is in Belgium, so in Diegem, close to Brussels, and the main site is in Roussette, south of France, near Aix-en-Provence, for those of you who know that. It's a very nice place, close to the Mont Saint-Victoire, that's very famous from the Cézanne pictures. So this division makes chips, secure microchips that are used in banking. Originally it was mostly banking and ID cards, telecom SIMs, TPMs, but also nowadays we try to focus on the market of Internet of Things, smart grid, and all of that. And the division in Belgium, it's a bit of special thing, because I've been working there since 1996. That's more than 20 years, with the same people, but we're only ST since 2003. So in the beginning we were the security division of a bank authorization host called Banksys that did the authorization of debit transactions in Belgium. And the same people stayed together, well, a lot of them stayed together until now. So, but we went through different companies, and now we're in ST since 2004. And in that context, we are not like ST wants to sell chips. That's the goal. Sell as many chips as you can. We try to are more solution oriented. So we work with the customer to try to get a solution for their problem, trying to look at it from a risk analysis perspective to have a cost efficient solution that does not completely eliminate fraud but limits it good enough. So that it doesn't cost more than the fraud you prevent. So at the lower level, we do specs, chip specification, HSM specifications, personalization specifications. Even at the lower level, we do development. So we develop the code of our own specifications, mostly software that we do. The hardware part is in the south of France. We do final products, so these products that we define ourselves for the customer, we also develop, but we also do development for other parts of the company. So libraries, crypto libraries, for instance. And then on the side, there is some crypto research. So that was already mentioned in the introduction. So yeah, I'm not going to go through all this, but I think what's maybe interesting is this permutation-based crypto, because in the process of doing this submission to the SHA-3 competition, we realized more and more that permutation-based crypto would be much nicer than block cipher-based crypto. And block cipher-based crypto, in my opinion, was basically a historical mistake. And it should have been permutation-based crypto from the start. But we try now to do the promotion of that, and I would like to have given a talk about that here, but I think that would be a bit too technical. And also the organization preferred me to talk about something more secure, module-oriented. So let's go back to security modules. So these secure chips, they were known as smart cards. And it's basically a dedicated technology focused on crypto security, doing crypto in a secure way. So it started very long ago, in the 80s, I think it's 40 years ago, about now. Initially, it was meant for banking cards. But later, it was also quickly used for pay TV or things like access badges. And while in the beginning it was not so very secure, it became better over the years for several reasons. So there was the economic reason. So in this pay TV, there was a lot of piracy going on, and they had to every time get the better chips, and the attacks would get better and so on. So it was kind of an arms race where the chips got better and the attacks got better and so on. But since, I think, 2000, or maybe a few years before 2000. There's also an academic community that has been focused on these aspects. It's the people that go to the chess conference or FDTC, or there are a number of conferences, CARDIS, several conferences dedicated to that, and they look at this technology in a more, let's say, ethical hacking sense. Huh? While, of course, the pirates are not so ethical, they're just out in it for the money. And also a lot of labs, since the establishment of common criteria evaluation, a lot of labs have specialized in attacking chips, also for ethical reasons, to make the chips better, basically, or to evaluate the chips. And this has led to very, very secure chips nowadays. Well, of course, these chips are not unbreakable. Any chip can be broken, but the effort, the amount of money, and the expertise you need to break it is really going up and up. So such a chip has a lot of built-in protection against all these attacks, side channel attacks, fault attacks, radiation, so electromagnetic analysis, also trying to get the key material from the non-volatile memory to do reverse engineering and all that. The point is that such a chip is orders of magnitudes harder to break than just an ordinary CPU. So if you do crypto on an ordinary CPU and you get access to, for instance, the power consumption and so on, you can get much more easily the chip out than on such a secure chip. So to get to that result, you need a lot of hardware, software co-design that is quite sophisticated, and also takes a lot of time and a lot of effort. And I know that because I've seen it done in ST, between the site in Roussin and the site in Diegem. So we got a very nice technology developed over the years with more than 40 years of experience that is very good to do cryptographic security. So if you look at what's happening in the real world, we see that actually most platforms, they do have a secure chip on board. So on a smartphone, you got typically a SIM. I think you still have a SIM now. I don't know. They're trying to get rid of it, but I think it's still there. And even more and more what they call a secure element. On a TPM nowadays, on most laptops, I think there is a TPM. You can discuss whether that's a good or a bad thing, but it is a secure chip. It's made of this technology that was developed in the smart card arena. Still, if you look at the crypto, what we see more and more is that the crypto is moving to the main CPU. On the smartphones, you get apps downloaded, and they have keys in the app. And these keys are protected by things like white box crypto. If I put my academic hat on, I cannot take that seriously. Yeah, but there's a lot of money in that, because it's kind of security of white box crypto is based on wishful thinking. We hope it works, so we throw a lot of money at it and hope it works. But up to now, I don't think there have been white box crypto schemes proposed that actually resisted attack for a very long time. It works for a while, but then it's broken. Another trend is to move the crypto to the main CPU, but then in a kind of separate subpart, so-called trusted execution environment, which is better than nothing, but it still it doesn't meet this security criteria of the smart cards. Also, smart cards themselves, the rollout is slow, so if you, for instance, pay on internet, at least when I pay on internet something with my Visa card, I think now I have a MasterCard. The security is based on on nothing, basically. Yeah, there's no real security. Yeah? So it's probably some risk management where they see that if there's too many payments being done, they block you or something. Or they send an SMS or something like that. So it's not really actual security, but apparently they can control the fraud. So why is that the case, that these chips are there, but they are less and less used? The problem is, I think, that it's hard to get the keys of the application keys, into the secure element. And the business reason is that the stakeholders, they are competing with each other. So they're fierce competitors. They're not inclined to collaborate. If the phone, the secure element, if it's owned by, I don't know who would own that. I think in Europe, it's mostly the operator. And the one that wants to get the keys in is like Google or something. They are maybe competing for the user's data, or they're competing for the access. So they are not likely to collaborate. I don't have a solution for that, of course. But there is also a technical reason. If you look at the systems and the specifications and the protocols, there are many of them, and they're all much too complex. And every day now, there are new standards being written and put out, and there's just a proliferation of standards that is very bad. And that's more the part where I try to get at. So that was secure chips. Now let's take a look at where secure chips are actually good at. Security assurance. And this is basically some intro to common criteria, which probably most of you know better than me. But let me still remind you of the basic principles. So common criteria or security assurance is about when we have a security product, we deploy it, we want to know if it's actually secure. Yeah? But it's not really, we don't want to know if it's actually secure. We want to know if it actually improves our security, whether we get what we want from it. So we need to know what we want. We need to have a clear idea of what we want. That's often, if we talk to customers, it's not an easy thing, because the customer has a certain idea, and they always reason in terms of solutions. So, yeah, we want an RSA key of 2048 bits or something like that, but they don't know. Then you have to say, but what do you really want? Huh? And then you often only then discover what they want, even themselves. So in common criteria, this is called a security target. That's a document that gives a clear and unambiguous description, at least that is what it's supposed to, of what your security goals are. And you also must clearly state what is the attacker model, what is the attacker trying to do, and what access does he have. Often the scope is very limited. It's limited to one particular product or module in a big thing. Then the product that implements that is called the target of evaluation. And this target, will be the subject of the security assurance to what you actually will test, whether it implements what you would like to have. So you're going to verify that. And I during the presentations before me, I realized I forgot a very important point on my slides. That's testability and testing. So mind that. So first, you need to verify whether your functionality, your security you want, whether it functionally implements what you want. So this requires testing, of course, but also documentation. You need to document the thing on multiple abstraction levels. Typically, you get a top architectural functional level, then high-level design, low-level design, and so on, up to the code that you need to document. You need to trace everything through these documents. So if you have a description on the high-level architecture, then you should be able to link that to the things that are described at lower level. Otherwise, you don't know if it's true. And then you need to test all that, and you need to show that it's a consistent set of documents. Then you need to, this is functionally, so you have a description, you have your code, you have your documentation. Okay, that's good, but maybe it's easily thwarted. You can easily get around it. So it needs to be tested, kind of penetration testing or let's say ethical hacking-like testing, where you let it evaluate by an independent third party. This is typically labs with a lot of expertise, and they get everything. So it's white box. They get the specs, they get the source code and everything, and they're going to try to attack it, and they evaluate what the difficulty is to break this thing, how much resources, expertise, time it takes to do that. So that's a kind of security testing, but there's also functional testing. And the functional testing, you need to provide logs. Then you need to trace the production and engineering process. If your security of your system relies partially on secrecy of code, they always say, yeah, secrecy of code, that's security by obscurity, but it can help to protect against an attacker. And if you don't keep your code secret, well, the code is not secret for the evaluation lab, but the code should be secret for the hacker. Huh? If your code is in the open, if it's open source, it's very good for people to evaluate, but they can also try to find weaknesses. So keeping your code secret is often, in common criteria, part of the process. You need to trace your production process. So if you deliver source code and you deliver and you have your compiled code, or you have your description of your hardware, and you got your chip, then you need to trace this production, trace everything, so that you know there are no Trojans introduced, for instance, in the production process. You need to do all that. So that's a very tough job. It's a time-consuming job. It consumes a lot of money, and it's very it takes a long time. But in the end, you get some assurance that what you want, that you get what you want. So how do you get, when is this good and when doesn't it work? So first of all, your security target needs to do what you want. If you have something that is very secure but doesn't do what you want, it doesn't help. It depends a lot on the complexity and on the quality. If you have something simple, easy, described, and understandable, that's much better than something that is complex, of course. So that's both at the requirement level, at the implementation level. Also, modularity helps. If you can identify submodules with clear interfaces and clear functional requirements and security requirements, that also helps. Quantity. The more, the worse. The smaller, the better, of course. If you have many lines of code, you can have many bugs. That's very simple. But also, if you have many levels of abstraction, it can go wrong in many places. If you got many in an API with many functions, you can have unexpected behavior. Complex protocols are worse than simple protocols. You all know that, but think about it when you look into a new spec. Think about it when you see specifications. Also, volatility. The more stable, the better. So firmware and software updates, basically, it's good because you can correct bugs. Yeah, it's also liability. You shouldn't have bugs in the first place if you want security assurance. You need to understand what your attack surface is. So you can protect very well against, for instance, timing attack, but maybe the attacker can monitor the power consumption, things like that. You have API attacks at the logical level. All that looks at the product, but if you want to put your product in the field, there are keys to be managed. So you need to also understand about key management, key handling, and the risks there. So, well, often you see products being promoted saying, yeah, we got CC EAL 6 plus or EAL 7. That's not security assurance. That's just a label. That's just a stamp. Right? Security assurance is really thinking about the actual security. CC EAL is like, if the customer demands CC EAL 5, you get that and you can sell it. It's more like a stamp. It's not real security. So what are the factors that make security assurance difficult? Huh? Bad specs, bad standards. So mixing up requirements and solutions. Long documents that are long, that are complex, that are not sufficiently formally defined. So absence of finite state machines. You see that a lot in standards. Specification of one side of a protocol, so you have a protocol with two or more parties, you get specifications of only one side. So you see that, for instance, in the EMV specifications, where only the chip part is described. There is probably a description of the latter part, but it's not in the specs. Also, frequent updates, frequent enhancements, so new features that are introduced on a frequent basis. Every time when you introduce something new, you can introduce a weakness. So also platforms with rich functionality. So a modern CPU, high-end CPU, very hard to understand the security. Undocumented features, very bad. And software is the same. So if you get regular updates of software, it's very hard to get security assurance. Also heterogeneous. So someone takes some code from OpenSSL, some code from here, some code from there, compiles, it compiles, that's fine. That's not security assurance. Secure chips, they are actually designed with security assurance in mind. So you try to get your architecture, have a limited functionality, have a simple interface, and when you design and build it, try to keep it simple. And hardware, you keep CPU with limited functionality, memory, crypto accelerators, all these things, limited interface. So the goal of this thing is to get security assurance. So okay, so back to this key distribution problem that we had, where we have to get the key in a secure chip instead of having it in white box crypto on the main CPU. So we assume an implicit architecture where the applicative functionality is on the main CPU, and we delegate all cryptographic functionality, well, at least not necessarily all, but at least the relevant part of the cryptographic functionality to the secure element. So, the display and keyboard secure element is in general not so good to drive a display and a keyboard. And this goes through the... That's, of course, one of the weak points, because you can trick the user into typing in a PIN for a different application. Okay, that's something that is not addressed now. So in a secure element, what you typically do is encryption or authentication, electronic signature if you want non-repudiation of its legally binding signatures. You want maybe key establishment. And then you got some minor stuff like transaction counters that you always go up to have a nonce. Key ratification when you notice that many cryptograms or MACs came in wrong, then it's probably an attack, things like that. And possibly some data management like electronic value. In an electronic purse, you got that, for instance. Or when you get credit points, things like that in loyalty applications. So the problem we address is getting the key in this secure element. So let's say I got here a hypothetical scenario, but this is a bit old school, and now on the Internet of Things, and we can give much more catchy examples, but in many cases, we get to the same problem. In this case, Bob wants to travel to Paris. He wants to take the metro there, wants to visit some museums, and Paris could offer a kind of app where you can, in advance, get already a metro a subscription or things like that. So what Bob can do, he downloads the app from his app provider, and when he arrives in Paris, he can immediately, without the hassle, take the subway or go to the museum. So what for that, he needs keys in his smartphone, and we want to get these keys in the secure element, and these keys are typically for the Paris Metro, owned by the company that exploits it. I have called this Paris Metro, that's just a made-up name, and they have to get from there to the secure element. So now if you look at, there is already an architecture that could support it, or that actually supports it, but it's not really deployed in that sense very well. That's Global Platform JavaCard. So on the global platform card, you get, it's a multi-application card, so you can have support multiple applications, and these applications, the functionality for each application, we call that an agent. So an agent is of a certain type. It can do, let's say, an EMV debit transaction, or another type would be one that does MyFair, or another would be one that does a loyalty application. And each of these agents has its own keys and data. Now that's important. And the platform basically separates these agents from each other with firewalls. So you cannot from one agent go to the other. So these agents, the code of these agents doesn't have to trust each other. You get a separation and you interface with an agent with commands and responses. And basically what would happen is this, I added two slides earlier. The applicative part on the main CPU would be using this agent as a kind of cryptographic mini HSM, cryptographic processor. And that thing keeps the keys secure while doing the cryptographic application. So now such an agent, he has an owner, and in global platform, this is implemented by so-called security domains. So on the chip, there are dedicated agents that are called security domains, and they are basically used by the agent owner to control his agent. So it's kind of a delegate of the owner on the secure element. And there is a secure channel, so there are keys in common between the owner of an agent, the owner of a security domain, and his security domain. And basically, this secure channel is a cryptographic secure channel providing authentication and confidentiality, and you can get the keys on there. So you can get keys on a secure element, but you need to have a key in common between the HSM of where the keys come from and the chip. So I think a few minutes, So we assume now the app provider, so the one that provides the app, has a security domain on the secure element. So I will not get to the point to explain how that happens then, but we assume that. And it's very simple. It's basically the application keys, they can go from the Parimetro HSM to the secure element in two hops. First hop is from the Parimetro HSM to the app provider HSM, and then from the app provider HSM to the secure element, basically that. And during transport, of course, these keys are always in a secure key envelope. That means the key data, the value of the key, the secret value of the key, but also the identifier and the attributes, they are wrapped. That means they are enciphered and authenticated. And they're only deciphered inside the HSM. So the key performed to do the wrapping is called the CAC. Yeah. So the first hop, that's the difficult one, because there we have two parties that are different. We have the Parimetro HSM and the provider HSM, the app provider HSM, and they require to share a CAC. But that's actually not so difficult, because you can use PKI for that. You can say, okay, how does Parimetro trust the app provider? Well, you can say that the app provider only gets a certificate if he has undergone an audit, security audit. And that means it can be trusted. It's kind of, there can be some liability contract things, but this can be done. This is something that's quite common in the banking world. And then from then on, the keys just travel in the domain of the app provider. So what is missing there, this is quite standard stuff, what is missing there, I think, is that there is no standard key envelope. So the main feature of this protocol is that there are never clear text keys outside the HSM or secure element. So the key always goes from one party to the other inside an HSM, then outside the HSM in the envelope, inside the HSM unwrapped, rewrapped again, and to the chip on the smartphone. So what I think would be interesting, and we've been in fact been saying this for already a long time, is it would be good to have a standard key envelope. A key envelope for between HSMs, so standard across all brands, so a kind of common standard that would be widely supported, and also from HSM to secure elements. So the standard would cover encoding of the payload, so how you encode key values, well, in general, that's well established, but key identifiers, because key identification is mostly proprietary, including the owner ID, the key where the identity of the entity that is the owner, key attributes, and then you also need to identify the key that encrypts the keys, so the keys that are used to secure these things, and the key wrap algorithm, where preferably you have not too many choices, not 20,000 options, no protocols with just one single or maybe two. Preferably the same for the both cases. The HSM secure element case is already documented now. It's possible, but it's outdated. So in GP, it uses some old crypto, or it's too much, leaves too much freedom. So we think this can be done in a simple specification that can be subject exactly to security assurance. So this is the end. So we see there is a tension between the evolution of technology that goes really at a very rapid pace and invades all our lives, and the security assurance we would like to have, because we cannot, it's very difficult to look at, to get security assurance for a moving target. But if you look at key distribution, the principles of sound key distribution, they don't evolve. It's always been the same, but we just understand them better now. And the technology we have, this secure chip technology, is getting better every day, in fact. So we think if there is trust, you can get secure key transport to a secure element, but a standard would certainly help in this. I hope I didn't bore you too much. Thanks for your attention.
All right, everyone. That brings to a close our keynote presentations. Please adjourn to the exhibits area behind us. The conference will continue at 11 a.m. Quantum Safe Crypto is in Ballroom A, the Industry Vertical Embedded Crypto in Ballroom B, General Technology is in Ballroom C, and Certification Programs in Ballroom D, E. Thank you.